Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Content Clearinghouse. I'm Brett Chisholm.
And I'm Josh Evans.
And on today's episode, we talk about man's best friend and my new best friend, Mando the Quaker Hound. And then Josh gets into the underground world of Russian video games and post-apocalyptic trains with Metro Exodus. Honestly, it's really just an excuse to talk about the world ending, like everything we talk about.
Movies, shows, and video games, podcasts, books, and their acclaims. Let their favorite content become yours. It's the Content Clearinghouse. Content Clearinghouse.
And it starts right now.
Brett, how are you?
I'm doing awesome. I'm actually on cloud 10. It's one step above cloud 9.
That's much higher than most people go. Why are you so happy?
Well, I think you know the answer to this.
That's true. I'm being coy.
Ooh,
for the listener's sake.
That's the perfect word. I'm actually talking about that word in my off top here.
So we
have a new addition in the family, and you know who it is. It's Neowise Mandalorian Chisholm, or Mando, as we're going to call him.
World's simplest name. But also very awesome. A lot of good content references layered into that name. So, Brett, let me ask you, who or what is Mando?
So, Mando is a Quaker Hound, which every time we've told somebody in our travels, because we flew to Florida to get him, and we brought him back from Florida. We just got back to Grand Junction, Colorado today. And every time we've mentioned the breed, we get kind of a funny look. The Quaker is a rare breed, especially in the United States. They come out of Holland. They've been around. They're like hunting dogs that have been around in Holland for hundreds of years. Actually, since the 16th century, Quaker Hounds have been featured in these fancy paintings. Rembrandt, one of his paintings has a Quaker in it, but it's probably not
Quaker
spelled
was
how
his
you.
Muse.
Yeah. It's definitely my muse now. It's spelled K-O-O-I-K-E-R-H-O-N-D-J-E. But it's pronounced Quaker Hound, or Quaker Hound is like kind of the American.
A lot of random
version.
Letters.
Yeah, you know how Dutch things go typically. But that koi word, K-O-I, it literally means cage, and Hond, H-O-N-D-J-A, means dog or hound, and a decoy, it comes out of the word decoy, and it actually means an elaborate trap. And these in Holland, these dogs were used, they were used as to lure ducks because they have these beautiful, fluffy tails that are feathered, is the term, and they wave back and forth. And they attract ducks, and so they're meant to lure ducks into these elaborate traps.
Well, ducks are notoriously known to be idiots, so I can see that working.
Yeah, and also ducks are kind of just notorious animals anyway. But we're actually going to show Mando. We're going to be one of those people that starts going to dog shows, which we're pretty excited about. Actually, the breeder that we got Mando from, his mom was trained in what's it called? Not obstacle training. Obedience. Clearly, I'm
just seems like I'm the not, opposite.
Yeah. So obedience training it's like the dog and the owner or the handler is doing like this elaborate dance. Like they're using hand signals and a little bit of verbiage, a little bit of verbal commands, but it's mostly just directing with your hand, and the dog will just turn around you and stop and like move forward. I mean, it's almost like a remote control dog. It was unbelievable. I don't think I've ever seen like an obedience routine like that before, at least not up close. And I just was absolutely blown away. So now I really want to do obedience training with Mando.
Does he speak Dutch?
He might, actually. This is a very smart dog. He's like 8 weeks and 2 days, and he is potty trained. He can sit, he can go down, and he's already learning his name. And I mean, he literally hasn't had an act. I mean, flying on like 6 hours of airplanes and 2 hours plus of cars, and he hasn't had a single accident. That's pretty amazing for an 8-week-old puppy.
I'd say that's better than like 60% of humans at the age of 8 weeks. So that is very impressive.
It's better than me in my 30s, that's for sure.
Yeah, you don't know how to turn around yet. Still working on that one. So didn't you say that you are contractually obligated to show this dog? He's just like so special.
I mean, it is just like part of the ownership. It's actually, we co-own this dog with the breeder. But I grew up showing Brittany's, or at least my family did. And, you know, I thought it was a really interesting experience. It was a really cool experience. It wouldn't take very much to get his grand championship. I will admit that, like, reading the contract for this dog, I think we were both a little taken aback by some of the, like, verbiage, but it's pretty standard, and the breeder, it was just, like, so nice and so knowledgeable. And, you know, another part of this process that's been really interesting is the world of dog breeding. Like, there are wonderful people that want to, you know, protect the breed and participate in just this like wonderful experience with owners, with animals. And then there's, you know, people that are very motivated by money. And it didn't take long to figure out like there's just exceptional characters in that world. And then there's like a seedy underbelly. It's really interesting. And so I know there's a lot of people out there that say you should rescue an animal from a shelter, and like I completely support that, but I hope that you can understand at least. And I think it was really important for us, like we wanted to have this experience, like we wanted to become that couple with adult braces that's in Best in Show and maybe get a couple ribbons on our wall.
Well, I totally see where you're coming from, because I mean, we own a half pug, half Boston Terrier mix, a bug, if you will, sweet, sweet Polly. And that's not a type of dog that you would get rescuing. But I think it's, you know, it's important that those dogs are rescued. But also, if you're after something like what you're after, which is a very specific, I mean, basically a full-time job is what you've adopted, then you
best
have
job
to
in the world.
You have to go to a breeder. But I did have a question. How mad do you think the breeder would be if in like 6 months they see a picture of Mando and he's like super fat, like he can't stand up anymore? Would they come and get him, steal him from you?
You know, I'm pretty sure that there are terms in the contract that if you're not taking care of this animal the way they expect to, because I mean, you have to keep in mind, like, and I'm sure you realize this, but maybe not everybody out there does. Bree and I taking a dog into our life was such a serious decision and a serious commitment, and one that we have wanted to do for, you know, 5 or 6 years. I mean, we've been together for 10 years and we've wanted a dog for a good portion of that, but just couldn't do it because of our careers. And we just would never pursue owning a dog unless we absolutely could commit to it. And I mean, it's, you know, it's taken us being several years into our 30s before we felt like we were ready and our situation and our lifestyle could accommodate a dog properly. So like that's, you know, that's the level of seriousness that we take this, and that's the only, you know, that should be the minimum. But from that point on, it still took, I think, about a year. I mean, this was not like a, you know, I know a lot of people are adopting dogs kind of during the COVID craziness of just being stuck inside. And, you know, they're great companion animals, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but you shouldn't just bring a sentient being into your life on a whim, right? And so it, you know, this was a process that we started prior to COVID, but of course, like, we were pursuing more when we had that extra time during lockdown, but it still took a year to find a wonderful breeder who and to put us on the list. There's a lot of like a vetting process. So it was quite a process. I mean, it felt like you could adopt a couple of children in half the time. I don't think that's true, but it
spoken
kinda
like a
like
man
that.
With no children.
Yes, exactly. I was gonna tell you tonight how much I feel like I've grown up and become a dad and I'm like responsible for someone else, but I knew you'd laugh at that having two real human kids.
Well, I have a dog and two kids, so you're almost there. You're so close. You're like, I'd say the dog is maybe 1/8 of it, and then the rest of it is having kids.
I mean, the so ease are you of gonna, this dog is unbelievable. This is the best puppy.
He's already trained.
In the universe. He's already trained. And we were getting on the plane, and the kids are crying, and then there's some toddlers that are weeping, and it's like our dog's just sleeping peacefully like a little angel.
Don't worry, dog. Those humans will be much smarter than you. Just give them 10 years. So are you going to share any pics of Mando on the social medias?
Yeah, I think I can make that happen for sure.
Oh, yes. That'd be awesome.
He's got a face for social media.
So adorable. And that's great, man. I'm super happy for you. That is a big step. And it sounds like you guys, I really wouldn't expect anything less of you. You guys basically went 110% into the step, like adopting a requirement, you know, such as this, something you have to go and show him off, which is, I mean, I could see that being a really awesome activity to be into, you know, if it's like, if you jump into it whole hog and you just get good at it, I could see that being like a real like life pilot skill.
Yeah, I think it's something we're really looking forward to, and you can just build like such great bonds with these, you know, this particular breed is just so intelligent. And that'll just be just like a fraction of the kind of companionship that he brings us, and hopefully the adventures and just the awesome experiences that we can bring to him. But yeah, we're excited, man. He's adorable.
That's great. Not only will he bring you companionship, but he will also bring you some ducks.
Yeah, if I play my cards right.
Yeah,
he's programmed for it.
That's great. Congrats, buddy. I love
that. Well, what do you got going on in your content circuit?
Well, I made a big move this week in my content circuit.
Oh,
I finally saw Tenet, and my God, it was mind blowing. There was definitely a point about a third of the way through, I was like, I don't understand anything they're talking about. But what was so amazing was by the end of the film, I was like, I totally get it. And that's like, it's a very intricately woven puzzle. It's like the most Christopher Nolan thing that's ever existed. And you can tell like at this point, it's like his masterwork, which I think I don't think that movie could have existed without all of the groundwork that he's laid with his other movies leading up to it.
That's a great point.
Yeah, that was super sweet. And then I'm going to be diving into Always Sunny soon. So that's something that's like right on the horizon. I have a few other things I have to work through, but that is coming up quick on your recommendation.
Heck yeah. You know what? That show is the best. It's in my content circuit right now, but I got to tell you, Hulu kind of sucks. This is not a paid sponsorship for Hulu.
I haven't dove much into our content clearinghouse team account yet, but yeah, it doesn't seem like it's going to be the place where I spend the most time as far as streaming services go.
I mean, I think a basic service that these streaming companies should have is the ability to download. And I guess this is kind of a new thing, but this is how quickly we just, you know, the newfangled qualities just become like the standard minimum. But you should be able to download episodes and watch them on an airplane. Well, guess what? My content circuit for this last week consisted of whatever I watched on the way to Florida and then whatever I watched on the way back. And Hulu was kind of blowing it by not letting me watch any downloaded episodes of It's Always Sunny. So,
oh man, that is total misfire in the world of streaming. Like, that's literally something every other service offers.
Oh, yeah, it like works seamlessly on Netflix, HBO, like no problems. But I wanted to watch Always Sunny, so. You know, to all the 40 listeners out there, if we can all get like a petition going, maybe we can get Hulu to spend a few million on their programming.
And stay tuned during the break for our new Hulu advertisement.
I don't think that's going to happen now.
Well, what about you, man? You got anything new?
Yeah. So I was checking out this show, Alien Planets. Have you seen that?
I put it in my queue. But it's at this point, I don't know when I'm going to get to it.
Yeah, it's kind of fun. It is interesting.
Is it good?
It is good. So they are kind of using CG, and they're building these alien worlds that could potentially exist. But everything is sort of backed up. Like every like mechanism or function or type of creature in the show, they back up with a real-life surrogate. So something, you know, in the animal kingdom or like some kind of human technology. So it kind of like brings in all these stories. So the very first episode, you know, you're kind of at the start, you're thinking like, this might be a little goofy. This is, you know, just this sort of imagination. Like, let's let it run wild. But you got paragliding, you got peregrine falcons, you've got the BBC filming crew for nature documentaries filming some beetles getting it on. It was incredibly entertaining, and I can't wait to watch the rest of them. So if you're just looking for something like really interesting and educational in a way that I haven't seen before, Alien Planets, it's pretty fun. Then of course we watched Best in Show on the way over there. It is a
you got
great
to
documentary. Two left feet, yeah. And adult braces. And then on the way back, I was thinking of you, and I wanted to watch some horror movies. And I really struggled. It's been a long time since I've seen this movie, but Saving Private Ryan is unbelievably good.
It's classic.
But I can barely watch the first like 15, 20 minutes of it, which I think is exactly how they intended. I mean, they don't pull any punches with just like how complicated and
so
how
rough.
Awful and terrifying war is. It is. That is a wild movie.
It's crazy that actual humans did those things. Like, you watch that movie and you just like the amount of fear suppression you would have to be putting yourself through to just come out of that, you know, that boarding boat or whatever that thing is that comes up on the beach, you know, just to force yourself against your own survival instincts to run out there into that, like, the hail of German machine gun fire. It's just, it's crazy. And then it's crazy when you think about the people that, like, came through the other end, how so much of it is just random luck, like who survives and who dies. It's really, like, one of the most incredible and unbelievable things that's ever happened on the planet, yeah. at least in, you know, recorded history.
It definitely seems like those first couple troops at the front of the assault or the offensive, I mean, they're just cannon fodder. I mean, it's, you know, what are you supposed to do? It's unbelievable.
You're just there to get them to deplete their ammo reserves until the next two or three waves come in.
Yeah.
It's awful.
Yeah. Well, great, great film. They did a fantastic job, you know. God, and that was like 1998 or something. But I mean, it really holds up. It's fantastic. But it was hard for me to watch just to get through that beginning. I'll be honest about that.
Well, you heard it here, folks. If you're have been on the fence about whether you should watch Saving Private Ryan and whether you think it's good or not, you heard it here on the Content Clearinghouse.
After
it is good.
After its bucket of Academy Awards that it won.
Yes, if the Academy Awards were not enough for you, then hearing it here should tip you over the edge.
All right, well, Let's take a quick break, and then when we come back, we'll get into some content. All right, welcome back to the Content Clearinghouse. Josh is going to be talking about something today. I wish I knew what it was.
Well, you're about to know, Brett. Just stick around. Keep your ear holes open. So this is something that I was planning on doing for the last several weeks, and then I just kept getting sidetracked with other content. But if there's one thing that doing this show has pointed out to me, it's the avenues that my content likes to travel in. And those things are horror, sci-fi, zombies, post-apocalyptic, video games, podcasts. This content that I'm covering today pretty much encompasses all of that except for podcasts, because there are no podcasts in the irradiated world that I'll be discussing today. So I'm going to be talking about a video game called Metro Exodus, which is so good. It's Metro Exodus is a first-person shooter game with survival, horror, and stealth elements. And the story starts in the cramped metro tunnels of Moscow, and it evolves into this semi-open world adventure where you steal a train and you begin this cross-country adventure in search of a safe space to relocate your entire community. So you travel by train to these new areas that you explore on foot, and you spend your time there like gathering supplies, weapons, and equipment, the things that you'll need to solve the mysteries of this post-apocalyptic Russia, as well as upgrading your train to strengthen it against the dangers of this radioactive world that you're traveling through. And this video game series is based on the novel series Metro 2033 by Dmitry Glukhovsky. And these novels, they are about a post-apocalyptic Russia and about the society that evolves in the metro tunnels. And this is an idea that was something that Glukhovsky was familiar with because he grew up in Russia. He was 10 years old when the Berlin Wall fell. He was 12 when the Soviet Union collapsed. And at 18, he published his first novel, which was Metro 2033. And it's this post-apocalyptic dystopia inspired by the chaos of 1990s Russia, set in Moscow's subway system, where the last survivors of a global nuclear holocaust retreat to rebuild their society. And Glukhovsky put the manuscript of this book on his website, where it got more than 2 million downloads in Russian. And that eventually led to a book deal when he published the book in 2005. Metro 2033 became an instant success with more than 5 million copies sold. And that eventually led to it being optioned for video game adaptation by a Ukrainian Maltese video game developer named called 4A Games.
Wow, you know, Russia, that is a scary backdrop, like a 1990s post-Cold War apocalypse. So what was the video game that we've covered on the show that you discussed that was in, was it Bolivia?
Ghost Recon Wildlands.
Ghost Recon Wildlands. So do you think Russia had a problem with one of their own kind of making this like fictionalizing their mother country?
It doesn't really seem like they did. It was very well received, and there was precedent in real life for the metro system that he's positing in the book. So according to Russia's Ministry of Emergency Situations, in the event of a nuclear attack on Moscow, there is space in the underground for all the population of Moscow, roughly 9 million people. And this bunker culture was kind of like a huge focus in Russia during the Cold War. So it's kind of, in a way, like glorifying this infrastructure that they've put so much work into. Now, who knows? Wow. You know, being here and not having any like cultural touchstone, it's hard to say, but I didn't find any information about it being a problem.
I mean, there's plenty of dystopian stories set in the United States, and like nobody penalizes those content creators. But I just, you know, it's hard to say what the culture of Russia was like then, because I don't know. But I would be scared to like speak out against my government if they were Russia.
Well, it's not really speaking out against it. It's more of like the nuclear war has already happened, and
gotcha.
It's not really the focus of the story. It's more about like what humans do in the aftermath.
Gotcha.
Which there's plenty of interesting material to mine there that they never really need to go into how the war actually happened. It's never, at least in this game, it was never covered.
Gotcha.
But I did find some really interesting stuff about the Moscow Metro. So the Metro is specifically engineered to protect against nuclear attack, and it's not only built deep enough to resist that, but its reinforcements in the tunnels and the blast doors, it allows for a total seal against blast pressure and fallout. And it was a big thing that they were putting a lot into, but there was a period of stagnation, like once the Cold War ended and, the world calmed down just a little bit, it wasn't something that they were perpetually funneling money into. But it seems that recently the government of Russia has started spending money on this aspect of their infrastructure again. There was a program in 2015 that started to renovate these old civil defense bunkers, and large-scale drills were undertaken in 2016, which involved over 40 million people. So that's great. What do they know that we don't know? It sounds like they're ramping up for something, which is kind of crazy to learn about.
Well, everything that I hear when I listen to like a podcast about a nuclear war, whether it's the history of it or the potential of it in the future, there's a great podcast on this who is, I can't remember the gentleman's name. I think he's in his late 80s now or his 90s. And, he's been a part of the government and working on these programs for decades. And now his granddaughter has kind of taken the helm, and she's trying to spearhead this organization to help educate with the eventuality of denuclearizing. But the show's called At the Brink, and there's also been a book written by, I think, this guy's granddaughter. It's just unbelievable. I mean, the close calls that we've had and how close we are constantly to being at the brink of a nuclear war. I mean, there's very, very smart people that say it is one of the number one existential threats that we're all facing. And that's
terrifying
when you compare it to like climate change, and that, which is an obvious and known existential threat, but it also seems like somewhat nebulous. And, it's nebulous enough, or it's like a long term enough of a thing that even though the science is clear, we're not doing anything about it. Like, we're not really taking any meaningful action. So I don't know. I guess that's one advantage of the fright of a nuclear war, is that it's like very clear. It's very obvious what could happen. But I guess we're just, it's like, oh, it didn't happen then, so we can all relax. But there's still a chance it could happen in the future. There's nothing stopping it. Like, there's probably more nukes now.
Those weapons still exist.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And it's so crazy that a big part of what was preventing it was the idea of mutually assured destruction, which is such a terrifying stalemate that it needed to be pushed to that level to prevent it from happening. It's like after World War II, everyone saw like the horrors of what would happen when you drop these bombs, but it didn't stop the superpowers of the world from ramping up production, and to the point where something like, Metro 2033, the series, exists because it is a comment on the world after. And that kind of fiction is typically a way to like work out your fears of this kind of occurrence. And it's crazy that this is something that's like it's looming over all of us at all times, but you can't really think about it. You can't focus on the fact that something could go wrong. Nukes could rain down. Sorry, listeners, don't focus on that. Do not Think about that.
2020's been a great year. You don't need to worry about a thing. Everything's fine.
Nothing ever goes wrong. Well, as you would expect from a story like this and a video game, like, even though there's precedent for this system to exist in real life, this Metro system, most of the game is spent fighting irradiated monsters.
Oh, yeah. And
Glukowski said that the inclusion of the monsters in the story is a comment on the xenophobia that was rampant in Russia during the Cold War in the early 90s. And the monsters were a stand-in for the immigrants and the way that they were treated in Russia. So in 1993, there was a study, a xenophobia study. It said that about one-third of the people who participated in the study were convinced that non-Russians were to blame for all of Russia's social woes. And the view that non-natives had an inordinate influence on Russia was shared by 54% of those polled. So that is, I mean, it definitely seems like this was something that he was living with, you know, growing up in Russia at the time.
Yeah, you know, it's great. Just blame the others. It's almost always their fault. And
it's something we deal with here, too.
It's somebody's fault. So, and it's not the people that look like me.
I'm perfect. So clearly, all this communism has nothing to do with me. But according to one of the studies, the sense of xenophobia is common in totalitarian areas, not only due to the immigrants, but also because of the inefficiency of the ruling authorities and the sense of insecurity, the general distrust of the establishment. So this is, you know, like typically like that xenophobia, according to the study, is much higher in places like communist Russia because it's kind of like, it's kind of indoctrinated into you and you're looking for something to blame and you're like, you're taught to not blame your government.
Yeah. I could see that happening. You know, those sort of lines between that, where you can draw lines between groups of people. Saving Private Ryan did a fantastic job with that of exploring, you know, like these people that even look the same, basically, you know, but they just speak a different language. They're wearing, you know, different insignias, and it's like, man, we're all human beings. But once you draw those borders, it just seems like you're asking for violence.
Think about how much easier it would be to oppress these guys if they were irradiated monsters.
Exactly. You know, now, I don't know where I want to draw the line with my kumbaya. You know, I want all natural and living things to get along, but irradiated monsters might be where I draw the line.
Even mutants?
I don't know. It depends how cute they are.
Yeah, that's true.
Do they have big eyes? They're really sweet.
They're very well trained. They speak Dutch.
they sit and they stay.
Yeah. Oh, just like your dog. So, Brett, I am not a cultural anthropologist. I'm just a contentologist, so I can really only go into what I read. But regardless of the efficacy of these studies, the concept of xenophobia in Soviet Russia certainly provided this game with the inspiration for some cool monsters to fight.
Yeah.
So
racist monsters or some cool monsters?
Well, luckily the racist overtones are lost in the video game adaptation, and you just end up fighting really awesome mutants. But there's this really cool storytelling device that catches you up if you've never played the other games. Like, this is the third game in a series, and I hadn't really played the other games, but the intro cinematic is you're inside a Metro car, you're looking out the window, and you're presented with these different vignettes. So the first one is this normal Moscow morning. And you're just traveling over the city on the raised rail track, and you see all of the country's ICBMs on the horizon, like launching up into the sky. And then as you pass into the Metro tunnel, there's like this white hot flash, and it washes everything out. You barely escape this fireball of like the American nukes coming in. And then you see like you'll pass through different platforms, and each one shows like a different scene of like panic, you know, like civilians rushing to try to, you know, get to safety. And then a different station, there's a time jump and you're watching civilians going to toe-to-toe with this oppressive military force. And then another station, there's another time jump. And it shows the rise of these new underground factions. There's like a communist faction and a Nazi faction. And then like the kind of the normal civilian faction and life of the survivors. It shows the life as these new communities form. It's a very cool way to catch you up on what happens or what has led up to the story where you're picking up. And you play this character. Gotcha. You play this character Artyom, and he's becoming this elite military operative known as a Spartan. And the Spartans are like these extremely skilled fighters. They're good at survival. They know how to use the resources from the wasteland above. And they're basically like the ultimate warriors in this world. And that's kind of like your jumping off point. You know, you start off as this guy who is good at pretty much all the skills you would need to survive above and below ground in this nuclear wasteland. And from that,
do you hunt and gather above ground?
Or not for food. It's mostly for like you gather resources to maintain your weaponry and to build like ammunition and fix your gas mask, things like that. So you are searching for equipment and like metal parts and things like that that you can break down.
Is it uninhabitable?
Yeah, above ground, you like there's places where you can't go without your gas mask on.
Gotcha. So it's like mostly underground. The game takes place.
Well, it starts off that way, but you end up leaving the metro, and as you do, you know, you start off with like equipment that is mostly like skeletonized weaponry, and then to get upgrades, you kill or subdue enemies, you strip them of their weapon parts, you upgrade your stuff at these workbenches, things like your flashlight. When it starts to run low on battery, you have to pull out this like homemade hand crank charger and charge it back up. And when you're doing all this, like when you're maintaining your equipment, the world just keeps going on around you. So you're always looking for like these safe pockets of like refuge where you can hunker down and maintain your equipment, which is really cool. Like it really makes you think strategically as you're playing. It's not just like charge in and fight. You're always looking for like a safe zone, somewhere that you can hide, fix everything, clean everything. And every move that you make feels just like super important in this game.
Man, that sounds absolutely crazy. I imagine any move you make in a post-apocalyptic world would matter tremendously.
Yeah, and it's this is a certain type of game that I really enjoy, like a disempowerment fantasy, because you know, you're not a total badass, even though you are like this Spartan, you're still very fragile. You know, you could fall like 8 or 10 feet without getting hurt. There's no auto healing. Your weapons will jam up. Your equipment will break. You have a button specifically for wiping your gas mask off when it starts to get like foggy or dirty.
Oh, wow.
And then if you fight in your gas mask, it'll also get cracked. So you're always juggling these battles between like, do I want to fight right now? I'm in an irradiated zone. Or do I want to like kite these enemies out of this area or just run away? And a lot of times there's no advantage to like killing the monsters because they don't give any resources. They basically only exist to give you like these speed bumps and roadblocks in the world that you have to work your way around. And it's really cool that a game can make not fighting the enemies so interesting, because so much of the time spent in the open world areas of this game, I was just like hiding, watching, figuring out like the patrol patterns of the enemies in a way that I could get around them without wasting any ammunition or, you know, risking damaging my equipment fighting them.
This game seems like it brings out the action sports flow state enthusiast in you, because if your gun can jam and you can just fall, if it's like real life except higher stakes, I don't know, because I know you mentioned the last time we hung out that you're clumsy, but when you're, that's something you like about action sports. You're always knocking things.
I'm very clumsy.
But you participate in these sports where like you cannot make a mistake and it just dials you in and you like don't trip over things. it seems like this game, I don't know, I'm just like maybe reading into it a little bit, but it seems like it might be some of the appeal for you because you like that sort of thing. You like to be tuned into something.
Well, I think that anything in the real world where I'm forced to focus, you know, it like kind of like pushes my clumsiness down, which is really nice. And I think it's part of why like this type of fiction is appealing to me. Because, you know, like everyone likes to imagine that they would be the hero. And this puts you directly into that world. And it really, like, it questions your decision-making ability. And all of it is slightly gamified, obviously, because it's designed to work, you know, through a TV and a game controller. But it's still, like, the same kind of tactical decision-making and the same kind of resource management that has some analog in the real world. And, you know, it's like watching, you know, apocalypse fiction or zombie fiction or reading it, whatever. You're always thinking like, oh, yeah, what would I do in this situation? And those are definitely headspaces that I like to put myself into.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely want to know more about the monsters as well. Are they like zombies? Or are they more like Hills Have Eyes mutants? Like, what are we working with here?
So you got like giant mutated dogs, which are basically like these werewolf monsters.
Ooh.
There's these crab monsters. And there's also, you know, like humans that have been irradiated and kind of like lost their mind. So you have like a bunch of just kind of like classic wasteland creatures to fight. But you also end up fighting, you know, there's human enemies that you're fighting as well. And like in the first battle in this game, I was really reminded heavily of the first time that I fought like really good AI in a video game, which was Half-Life, which is a game I've talked about here before. Like this, it's a game from 1998. And I remember the first time I fought like the human enemies in that game, and they were using like flanking tactics and distraction and all this stuff where I felt like I might be like fighting a human on the other end of it. You know, that was like kind of a transcendent game experience for me. And that really reminded me of like what the intro battles in this game were like. You know, the enemies were attacking intelligently. They were working together. They were flanking. And that was, you know, at that point, I was like, man, this game is going to be amazing. But it really just evolved from there. It became so much more than that as they started to introduce the other enemy types and as the game kind of like moved out of the metro and into the open world.
Soon the AI will not just be something we fight in video games, but it'll be something we fall in love with too.
So true. And when they wrap it into that beautiful love doll body that you've always wanted, Brett.
I had to make sure our dog wasn't a automaton. Like it's just so perfect.
Just too dang smart.
He's just so smart and so good. And then he finally like farted or something. And I'm like, okay, he's a real dog.
Mortal. So let's I want to tell you about the train. Like I've alluded to it a little bit. The train is a big part of this game. Like about 2 hours in, you steal a train from the metro and you take off like across country and you're looking for like non-irradiated safe zones. And what's really cool about this game, like this is something I've never really experienced before. Like the sensation of hunkering down in a storm is so realistic in this because you're leaving in the middle of this like crazy snowstorm and inside the train, everything is like rattling around and you can hear the wind blowing outside the windows and you really get this sense of like there's warmth in here and outside there's like danger and cold and it's basically like the difference between being in the worst place on earth and being in like this small pocket of safety. It started making me think about like the human instinct to hunker down in a storm seems so ingrained. Like I know whenever I see a storm coming, I get a little bit excited because I'm like, okay, I have this house. I have like blankets and stuff and I can like get comfortable and I'm not in any immediate danger of the storm. So I can kind of like watch this amazing show in the sky. And, you know, that's a type of experience that I crave. And I know that that comes from some sort of deep-seated instinct to find safety, like from our caveman ancestors.
Yeah, it's like some kind of wiring built into us.
Yeah, like this really occurred to me whenever I went on a motorcycle trip with our good friend Derek, and every day of this trip, we would end up riding into like a crazy snowstorm or a crazy rainstorm, and I had really great like waterproof gear, and I remember like even though I'm on a motorcycle thinking like, okay, I'm riding into this thing that would be horrible to be stuck outside in, but as long as I can pilot my motorcycle properly, I know that I'm mostly water resistant. It was like being in a spacesuit, and it was crazy like how thin that veneer of safety can be. It can be just something as, you know, as small as like a waterproof jacket and good gloves and helmet. And that was, you know, that kind of made me think about my whole life, how much I've loved being safe during a storm. And I found this article in Psychology Today by this PhD, Jim Taylor. And he proposed, like I was looking into this, you know, what this deep-seated instinct is. And he proposed that the idea of our typical like fight or flight style survival instincts may be outdated in the world that we live in. And those instincts are probably failing us like on a basic level. Like our modern world is so much more complicated than just like attack or run away from something and hide from our problems. Like there's the old days of like, there's a storm on the horizon, find shelter. And you know, that just doesn't really prepare you for things like stock market crashes and housing crises and workplace politics or mandatory shutdowns during ineffective pandemic responses or any of the other like psychological trappings of being a modern human. Like our original survival instincts that allowed us to crawl up out of the primordial ooze and evolve into these beings that we are now. There's like people that have been to the moon. Like those original instincts are a little outdated with like the things that we face today. And you know, I'm not a cultural anthropologist or a psychologist, but I do believe that our lizard brains still kind of yearn for like those simpler problem solving issues, like the issues with just surviving. And that's why I think like this kind of fiction is so alluring, because it gives you a way to like tap into that as a modern human.
Yeah. I was just talking about this the other night, negativity bias. The thought that, or, you know, the observation that we hold on to negative things. So like, you know, you don't think about the 10 compliments you got today. You think about the one insult, you know, over and over and over. It's just our eight brains that, you know, it's not a bad thing. It was a good thing when we lived in the, you know, African desert, and it was fight or flight. It was survival. Thousands of years ago, tens of thousands of years ago. But now, the modern world, like, we're not running from saber-toothed tigers. Like, we're not hunting for our food constantly. But that negativity bias is still there because it's been honed through evolution. But yeah, when you were describing the train, that gave me some real Snowpiercer vibes. I'm going to have to talk about that movie at some point. Have you seen Snowpiercer?
Just parts of it. I haven't seen the whole movie.
It's a good one. And I have felt those moments of safety in our little Airstream cocoon.
Totally.
But you're right. There have been, I mean, we are actually exposed enough that if the storm is bad enough, like a travel trailer is not a house. It will not keep you as safe as a house. It's like
a rolling barrel.
It's like the condom of structures. You could
don't live in it too hard, Brett. You'll break it.
These thin walls are made for having a good time, but not surviving a tornado.
So much sensitivity to the outside world.
Snowpiercer.
So something like in this game, like I probably spent way too much time just riding the train, because you can leave like, eventually your train is, you know, like several cars deep, and it's got like, you know, like a, it's got the engine, but it's also got like living quarters, and it's got workbenches and all the stuff that you get to explore. And all the time you hear like the wind outside, you can look out the windows and see like water streaks, but you can also go out onto the front of the engine and just stand out on the front and just watch the landscape blow by, which I looked into this and couldn't find, like, from a technical standpoint how they created it, but just knowing, you know, roughly what I do about video games, I'm assuming that it was some sort of, like, procedurally generated, you know, they had pieces of landscape that they could plug and play into different different orders and basically create, like, non-repeating landscape created from basic elements. But you can just stand out on the front and you know, like, if I fell off this train, that would be it. I would die. One, I'd be injured horribly, but I'd also be stuck in the wasteland. So you're, like, out on the front and you can sit there and just watch the world blow by and see, like, the remnants of the world that's been left behind, which is something that in a game I've never really felt like almost like a real connection to the game that I was playing, where it's like, this seems like such a real scenario. And so for a long time, I would just sit out there and just let the game play and, you know, like, just watch the landscape and just kind of drink in, like, that emotional impact of the game, which is something that very rare for a video game where you're typically just thinking about, like, the best way to explode mutant heads.
Yeah. that's very interesting. I imagine an experience like that will be even more common when we are all sporting those Oculus Rifts
and
fully immerse. I mean, when I tried the I think it was the Quest, not the newest one, or I don't even know if the newest one is out yet. I was at our friends Tony and Tara's house, actually. Shout out to them. But I tried on, I think it's the Quest 1, or I don't know what it is. Anyway, one of the coolest things about it was just sitting in the theater room, virtual theater room, and just looking, like, at the art on the walls and the, like, table. I mean, you know, it's not even that the graphics themselves are very high resolution, but the immersion
just so
of
immersive.
It. So immersive. I mean, it really was like getting plugged into the Matrix. It was unbelievable. It totally exceeded my expectations.
It'll be interesting to see, like, when that technology evolves to the point where it's not a 8-pound headset and it becomes, like, something as small as, like, a pair of glasses. That's whenever the technology is going to be impressive and amazing, but also, like, very dangerous, because there will be people that don't want to unplug. It's like Ready Player One. You know, that's a very real thing. Like, as that technology becomes more accessible, there'll be people that just, there are people now that just live on their computer screens.
Right.
And just the allure of diving into the internet. Just imagine when it is completely immersive and 360 degrees surround sound, and the graphics are only going to get better. You know, it's not going to be shittier than it is now.
Right. Yeah, I was, you know, I thought we were further behind in that technology than we were. I mean, I knew about the Oculus. I knew it was coming. I just did not realize how good it is right now. Like, it is, if for listeners out there, if you haven't tried it, it really is quite unbelievable.
Don't be afraid of getting sucked in and never being able to escape or speak to your friends again. I'm sure that won't happen to you. Just try it. VR, it's amazing. I wholeheartedly endorse it. I love it. I've talked about VR on this show before.
Yeah.
But there was something about the train, getting back to that, like, I wanted to, there was a thought that I had. This is something that's happened in my real life. Like, I had this thought, like, when I was playing the game and you're in these crazy open worlds and you're, like, in all this danger, you know, from the game's point of view, there were times where I was like, I can't wait to get back to, like, one of the train sections when, like, all, like, the hopped up stress of playing the crazy parts of the game are, like, you leave them behind, you get to do this, like, another 15 minutes of kind of relaxing. It's so strange that a game can make you feel that, but it's the same type of feeling that I have, like, when I'm skydiving. But, and I'm having, like, the best time of my life, but in the back of my mind, I'm always kind of motivated by, like, getting back to my home at the end of the day safely. And that's, you know, it seems like doing extreme sports, that'd be the last thing from your mind. But for me, that's always a big motivation of, like, everything I'm doing. Like, at the end of the day, I just want to go home. I want to go big and then go home. Is how I always thought about it.
Go big and then go home. That old classic saying.
Yeah, why do those things have to be mutually exclusive? You could do both of them.
Yeah, dude, exactly.
That's how you avoid getting hurt.
Yeah. Go big or
go home. Is that how you feel when you're doing action sports?
Honestly, I so relate to it. First skydive of the day for me, like when I'm kind of in the groove of just like, okay, what are we doing next? Okay, and I'm like thinking of like something I screwed up landing my canopy or like, you know, just flying
negativity
a pattern.
Bias.
Or, yeah, of course, because I can't think about the positives ever. You know, I'm like dialed in like later in the day and just kind of in the groove, like having fun, seeing friends, everybody's packing. But that first skydive of the day, there's always that voice in my head that's like, you don't need to be doing this. You're in your 30s. If you get broken, it's going to take forever to heal. Just like, this is dumb. And I just like always, I mean, every time I skydive, that first jump of the day, I have to like work through that a little bit. Like, no, this is that voice is stupid. That voice is wrong. I like doing this. This is fun. It is, but it is, you do feel like a sense of accomplishment at the end of the day when you're like home, you're safe. And I imagine it's the it's like a better sense of accomplishment than like golfing all day with your buddies. I don't know, you know.
Hey, you get struck by lightning.
That is true. I mean, it's kind of, you're probably like sunburned and tired and drunk at the end of a golf day, but
that sounds awful.
I don't want to compare sports and how many balls they take or whatever the stupid t-shirt says.
Skydiving requires both. From what I've heard,
I don't know anything. I really don't know anything about golf. People really seem to enjoy the shit out of golf. I've never understood it, but
it only takes one ball, though, Brett.
I saw this t-shirt, didn't buy it. But no, absolutely, man. I think we all like being a little uncomfortable, a little scared, but part of that, it's like music, dissonance and then consonance. Like you have to have tension and then release. And I feel like the danger and the fear is tension. And then, you know, coming home at the end of the day is the release. Yeah. But this, I don't know, in this post-apocalyptic world, I don't know if you're getting any release. Like it just all sounds kind of sketch.
Yeah, the world is certainly dangerous, but the fact that you can go back to the train and that you can actually like have that little island of safety is a really cool thing. Like it's just brought out things to me in a game that I never really experienced before, which is great.
So the train is home.
It totally is, yeah. And you like you customize it, you update it, so it like really is like your own little personal space throughout the game.
So go big and then go train.
Yes, that would make a great t-shirt. So there's something that I really love about beautiful desolation of the remnants of society in games like this and things like The Last of Us, you know, these like great post-apocalyptic games. And, you know, this really makes you feel like you are wandering through the last vestiges of a society that was almost too gentle to last. You know, it's like anything that is that modern with that many interconnected and artificial systems relying on each other for survival was never really destined to work. And eventually like some calamity would come along, just wipe any attempt at civilizing the world right off the map. And, you know, apocalypse fiction is so popular because, like I said earlier, you know, we all like to think that we would be the hero of the story, but most likely we'd all end up as like these irradiated mutants, you know, like a creature that you're avoided at best or killed off by one of the last band of survivors, or even worse, you're wandering around the wastelands forever, fueled by the radioactive runoff of the last great war. And games like this allow you to feel what it would be like to see everything around you crumble and like test your own mettle at survival. You live the highs and lows of one of these great reset periods of the earth where we feel the world is ending, but from a galactic scale, it's really just returning the balance back to nominal. And you know, if you like me like to imagine these scenarios and see yourself as something other than a victim of circumstance, and if you like to imagine you have what it would take to survive for some reason, like your soft suburban existence has prepared you for a cross-country radioactive survival adventure on ramshackle locomotive engine, then you should definitely play Metro Exodus. And if for some reason you find out that you're not good at it, you can always take the game back to GameStop and get a refund, because that's the beauty of our comfortable, cushy world that we live in.
Yeah, I've said this before and I'll say it again. I think it's a balancing act, because I don't want life to be too cushy, but I do like thinking about these scenarios or playing these types of video games or consuming this type of content, but I don't want to live in this world.
I don't actually either. That's why I love video games, Brett. But yeah. It allows me to live out all my greatest and worst fantasies and then just turn it off and go pet my dog.
Yeah. Yeah. That is the nice thing about video games.
And dogs.
And dogs.
So what do you think, Brett? You going to make the investment now to get all the equipment and jam it into your Airstream just so you can play this game? That totally sounds like something you would do.
You didn't. I'm running out of space rapidly. But what platform is this game on?
It's available pretty much on everything. Xbox, okay. PS4, PC, all the classics.
Well, I'll take one of everything and I'll find a spot for it.
Perfect. You'll maybe throw your one wheel out and you can make room for like three
there
video game consoles.
The one wheel's not going anywhere, buddy. You of all people should know that.
Throw out your skydiving gear then.
I got to draw the line somewhere, and it's not there.
Okay, so you're probably going to keep the dog. You're probably going to keep Bree and all your action sports equipment.
Bye, Bree.
Right, we'll figure something out.
Perfect. Well, thanks, Josh. That's amazing. I'm moving to Russia. I just bought some tickets online. I want to check out these tunnels.
There's a lot of space down there, 9 million humans worth of space.
Oh my gosh. That was a great plot point too in World War Z. The North Koreans just sort of disappeared and just went to their underground tunnels to never be seen from or heard of again.
I'm sure there was one zombie bite and just bam.
Yeah. There was like speculation in that book that they had removed all the teeth of all the inhabitants of North Korea, so they couldn't bite. Yeah,
that's so great. Yeah,
another
I forgot
good
about
one
that.
For the, yeah,
that's one I need to go back and read
one
again.
For the podcast.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that's one to revisit. Well, thank you so much for sharing your video game expertise with all of us and all your thoughts. And thanks to if you're one of our 40 listeners out there. My God, we love you. We make this show for you. There may not be many of you, but you are the best. You are the most special. You are the most attractive podcast listeners. I've been flying all day with a puppy. We love you. Thank you for listening to The Content Clearinghouse, and we will see you next week.